Misery, what is the problem with the world? Romans 3 verse 10 to 12. It is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. Deliverance, how do we correct that problem? Acts 4 verse 12. Salvation is found in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given to mankind by which we must be saved. Acts 10 verse 43. All the prophets testify about him that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name. Gratitude. How do we live ever after once we understand? Ephesians 5 verse 8 to 10. For you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Live as children of light, for the fruit of the light consists in all goodness, righteousness, and truth. And find out what pleases the Lord. Romans 12 verse 1. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. Is this your true and proper worship?
So this message was inspired by when I was watching Pastor Brian a couple weeks ago when he introduced question and answer 2 as part of his Heidelberg Catechism series. And the sermon there clicked with a bunch of things that I'd been reading and thinking about. I do a fair bit of thinking about a lot of things. And suddenly, as I was listening to Pastor Brian, I knew what I was going to do the first Sunday that I was going to be here. And so I've constructed this message that uses the Heidelberg Catechism as well, but in a kind of an overview way. And that's what it is. In the next two Sundays, because I'm here for three Sundays, I plan to do messages out of a series that I call Parables from Life. And if you were here when I was here before, you remember me doing maybe green eggs and ham as part of a sermon. There was a Bible passage as well. It wasn't just green eggs and ham, but it's in that kind of mode where I take a well-known story that many of us grew up with and I tie that with some texts and turn that into a message. So next Sunday, I'm planning to do Horton Hears a Who, along with some Bible passages. So it might be worth it for you to reread that. And the Sunday after that, unless things change, sometimes you get inspired to do something different. The Ugly Duckling. Hans Christian Andersen wrote some amazing stories that have some themes in them. Again, there'll be sermons along with Bible passages. But for today, we're thinking about the Catechism as Pastor Brian has been preaching it. As I go through the message, I'll mention some books and things that are what I was thinking about at the time when I saw Pastor Brian do his sermon. But if you don't catch them and you want to know more, you can always email me, or there's other ways of finding out if you want to read those for yourself. So the key to a good story is that it must have an interesting or relatable main character, a main character that catches your interest. And then they have to encounter a problem of some kind. And then the rest of the story is how they solve that problem. And then often the last short bit of the story is how they live ever after. So those are key elements in a good story. Interesting main character, but mainly a problem they encounter and how they solve that problem and live after that. So I start off by asking you this morning, here and online, what story are you living in? What story are you living in? What's your story is another way of saying that, but I'm talking about a bigger kind of a story. What narrative do you use to make sense of this world you live in? But that's an important question. All of us, as God-made meaning makers, human beings are apparently unique in that capability. We make meaning of events. As God-made meaning makers, we all have a story we're living in. We all have a story that we've created, that we live in our minds, that makes sense of the world for us. We are, in that way, the interesting character in our own story. We're the character who encounters problems and finds ways of dealing with them as we live our lives. It could be worthwhile to reflect on this question then: what is the story you are living in? The story or narrative that you see yourself as inhabiting shapes your view of the world, or worldview is another word we use there. And this works the other way around as well. The worldview you already have shapes the experience you will have of the world. Let me give a couple of examples. If you're a person whose story is, the world is out to get me, everybody's out to get me. I once was in Vancouver riding the SkyTrain, and I was sitting near a guy who was telling the guy beside him a tale of woe that was just amazing. The government was out to get him. The welfare department was out to get him. His parents were trying to hunt him down. Blah, blah, blah. It went on like that. The world was out to get me is what his story was. Well, you know what? Then when you're too busy talking and you miss your stop, that becomes part of the world being out to get you, right? And you're not taking responsibility for not paying enough attention that it was your stop to get off. So the story that that person lived in shaped their experience of the world. There's other ones, many other ones. I'm going to just give you maybe one other example. If you believe that you are unstoppable, that you can do no wrong, that you are here as an individual to change the world for the better, no matter what anybody else says, that's going to shape how you behave. It's going to shape your actions. It's also going to shape how you perceive other people responding to those actions. One of the readings that I've listened to lately is a book called The Coddling of the American Mind. And there it's two professors who wrote a book who started noticing in 2013 that colleges and universities in the U.S. particularly, but I think it applies in Canada as well, started experiencing a new wave of students who believed they were supposed to be protected from everything that was risky or dangerous in their lives. Out of that comes what we call now cancel culture. So if a speaker comes, is invited to a university, and is going to speak on a topic that is controversial in some way or threatening in some way to even just one person, then a movement can begin to cancel that talk. That's a radical change, as the book lays out, from what universities being established some hundreds of years ago as specifically places where you went to have all your ideas challenged and to sort them out afresh, to be guided in sorting those out. So safety culture, being raised by helicopter parents, as it's often called as well, where the parents work hard to protect their children from every obstacle, has raised a generation of children who seem to believe that they're supposed to be protected from everything. The government, the professors, the administration is supposed to protect them from anything that might threaten them, even just in their feelings. That's a huge change in our culture that we as Christians do well to think of in light, afresh, in light of the gospel message. So the stories we live in, the ones we encounter every day, shape our view of the world and our experience of it. Some other examples are Disney. I'm one of a generation who grew up with some of the classic Disney stories, and most of the other movies that were out for children were not safe enough for us to watch, so it was mostly Disney. And so the Disney stories I grew up with had princes who rescued damsels in distress. Often the princes were frog princes who rescued damsels in distress, and then they live happily ever after, experiencing the gratitude of the damsel that was in distress. I believed that narrative. I tried to live it. It turned out to be a lie. I'm working on a group lawsuit against Disney about that. I think that's just not fair that they deceived me that way. Right? And so we grew up with Westerns, and we've grown up with many stories that we watched as children and young adults and even as adults, and these stories have shaped it, us. Westerns, at one point, the good guy always wore a white hat, and so you just know how the story went. And the bad guy was wearing a black hat. And then the first Westerns came out with a good guy wearing a black hat, and it was very confusing because we had to change the narrative. But here's another layer of this, because those might be kind of obvious, that J.K. Smith writes about in a book called You Are What You Love, The Spiritual Power of Habit. And he points out that our broader culture has all kinds of rituals and habits that are part of daily life that we don't even think about. So materialism and consumerism as a worldview has malls and stores. And when the economy tanks, their priests stand up and say, we need to buy things to keep the economy going. That's a religious encouragement. And he points out in the book that when you make purchase in a mall and the clerk thanks you for having shopped there, that's a ritual. A consumerist, materialist ritual. You've kept the economy going, good for you, even though the thing you just bought might end up in the back of the cupboard after you've worn it once, right? But you've kept the economy going. You are what you love, the spiritual power of habit. It's a great, interesting read. Malls, these are some things that he points out there and that are kind of interesting to observe for yourself the next time you are in a mall. Two things out of many. But over time, cathedrals used to be the center of civilization. And now it's moved to kind of banks and business buildings, but also malls. Malls are the new cathedrals, or have been the new cathedrals. The pandemic might change some of that. We're in that kind of a change time. And when you go to a mall next, notice that it doesn't let you see the outside world except for the sky. What's the story there? Why do they do that? And now, in a day of cell phones and machines on our wrists, this might not be so true anymore, but still, you can walk around a mall and not find a clock anywhere. That's deliberate. That's part of the story that they are. They want you to get lost in time and in your consumerism. Okay? And so the same is true for video games. I'm not really an expert on that, but when I do read about them and watch that, explore it, they all tend to have a consistent narrative. I used to bug my kids when they were playing video games. This is a few years ago now, but one of them quoted it back to me just recently. Who would Jesus be in this game that you're playing? And what would a Jesus character do in this game? Oh, Dad, you know. But it's so interesting that now as young adults, and one of them is very much into gaming competitively, he claims he's in the top 6% in a particular big game in the world, but that he quotes that back to me. It means he's still thinking about it. Where's Jesus in this video game? And it's also interesting to me that the characters are all wizards and druids, and it's like J.R. Tolkien wrote the video game. What is going on there? What's the story? So the stories that we live in, superhero stories. I have a son-in-law who's into superhero stories. They shape our story, even when we're not thinking, especially maybe when we're not thinking about it. So the stories we live in, the ones we encounter every day, shape our view of the world, and we do well to be aware of that. Our worldview is an important thing for us, and we need to keep hold of it as a Christian worldview. One of the purposes of coming together for Christian worship, as we are doing this morning, is to be reminded of the grand worldview that we live in. the grand over-narrative or uber-narrative. That word has been hijacked. It used to be a great philosophical word. Uber-narrative of life. Do you know what your uber-narrative is as a Christian? Those who profess Jesus and claim to be his followers need constant refreshers, which is why we come together to study and to worship, constant refreshers about the greater story that we are part of. And the Heidelberg Catechism is one of our teaching tools that reminds us of parts of that greater story through asking questions and giving answers. And what I realized listening to Pastor Brian a few weeks ago is that the Heidelberg's three main categories of misery, deliverance, and gratitude give us a guide for ferreting out stories or narratives that are inconsistent with the story of the kingdom of God and Jesus Christ and his saving ways. So, today I want to equip you using the Heidelberg Catechism with three questions that you can now ask any worldview, of any worldview you encounter, any ideology. And they're Heidelberg Catechism categories. Any worldview or ideology you encounter needs to have three questions asked of it, and how it answers those questions will tell you how close it is to the way of Jesus. And it'll also tell you if it's not part of the way of Jesus. And then you've got some thinking to do if you discover that. So ask these three questions of any ideology you encounter, any worldview you encounter. What does it say is the problem with the world and with humankind? What's the misery? What's the source of our misery? What's the problem that humankind has encountered? And then, second, what is the solution to that problem? And third, what happens then? How does knowing the answers to those two things affect life beyond that point? And those three questions are about misery, deliverance, and gratitude, or life after. What is the source of the cause of the misery of the world? How are we delivered from that misery? And how do we live beyond that? How does that affect life? And this, a part of what I was into at the time when I heard Pastor Brian, was also a video interview with a Christian Reformed pastor colleague who's become kind of, in his own way, famous on YouTube. It started with, we were both interested in Jordan Peterson, the psychology prof, and particularly when he started giving lectures on the Bible from a Jungian perspective in Toronto, and people would pay $30 to hear a psychology prof give a lecture on the Bible. He started in Genesis, and he kind of got stuck there. He only got, he fulfilled his time. And he did that with churches within a six-block radius, let's say six churches within a six-block radius that are technically free, sitting empty. And for me, that was a moment where, hey, something's going on here. Why is the world willing to pay to hear him talk about the Bible? And most of what he said was close to what we would believe. And they're not coming to the churches. This is a chance for the churches to think about what we're doing and maybe make some adjustments. So, and I saw an interview with him. His name is Paul Vanderclay. A conversation between him and a young woman who had been raised Christian, rejected Christianity, became what's called a social justice warrior. That's a term that you might have been encountered. And then got disappointed with that and rediscovered what Jesus was all about. And then the third person was an agnostic atheist, I think. Paul seems to have a lot of connections with people like that. In fact, one of the problems he's having is in this internet community, many of them are becoming Christians. And so the conversation actually gets less interesting when they all become Christians. Isn't that something? But so that was all part of this. And I can link you to that too, if you want to see that for yourself. And that's where this idea of asking an ideology these three questions came from. Because a lot of the worldview that's out in the world today, a lot of the ideologies sound very Christian. They use Christian terminology, or that we're used to as Christians. Christianity has given our culture the language for self-sacrifice, for instance, which has become pay it forward. But pay it forward is not necessarily done with Christ in mind. Christianity has given us language for correcting injustice, for seeking justice, for creating a fair world, for equality. Christianity has given us language for taking care of the oppressed and the suffering victim. And it has given many more things. And these remain in the language of some of these ideologies, but they've been separated from Christ, is what I'm becoming convinced of. So they've taken on a life of their own in the world today. And so some ideologies that appear to fight for justice and equality are strong in our national stories. And a lot of this is necessary. Let me be clear about that. But they've become disconnected from their roots in the Christian story, the Christian Uber narrative. And that makes them something to be cautious about. If you want to learn more about how this has been happening, start with a recent book, I'm not finished it myself yet, called Dominion, by Tom Holland. He himself is not a Christian, as we know Christians. This is one of the things I love seeing about some of these people, where especially Christian pastors, when they interview them, want to get them to proclaim Christ in the interview. They did that with Jordan Peterson as well. And I loved how Jordan Peterson used to answer those. By the way, Jordan Peterson has had a year from hell. And I just read in the paper yesterday that he now has COVID on top of that. His wife almost died twice. He almost died. So there's the whole story there. But when he would get asked by Christians, I remember one around Easter, he was asked, "Do you believe Jesus rose from the dead?" Right? "Well, I need another 3 years to decide whether I believe that or not." Right? Well, this author, Tom Holland, does not profess to be a Christian, except that he says, morally and ethically, I could be called a Christian. But I'm still puzzled. I don't know exactly how he said this, but he still is puzzled over this Jesus thing. And yet this book, which reviews history from the time of the Greeks and the Romans and shows how Christianity took on bits of other religions that still remain for us, but how Christianity almost always had a faithful remnant that would rise again, for instance, in the Reformation, but then how it always went sideways again after that. And he starts this book, a secular book, with the crucifixion. And it's pretty clear if you follow the whole book that he's kind of indirectly saying there's something here about this guy who died as a thief on a cross under cruel torture. There's something there that I haven't figured out yet. And so, but he traces how Christianity has shaped the culture that we have right now to the point that even the atheists, the anti-God people, are actually shaped by Christianity or they couldn't exist. That's one of the arguments. So when you go out from here this week and encounter an ideology, a worldview, when you see a protest on the news, ask of it or its representatives if you get the chance. This afternoon, I get to be part of an interview. I've been asked to be part. This all grew out of the Jordan Peterson thing. A researcher, a sociology researcher from an institution that's not King's near in Edmonton here, is doing research on whiteness. And so one of the questions I have to answer this afternoon and tomorrow is, what does white skin privilege mean to you? And it's been a fascinating thing to think about. I won't get into all that, but that's, so when you encounter an ideology, a worldview, ask of it or its representatives, what's the misery? What's the problem you're trying to solve? And what is the solution to that problem? What's the deliverance? And how do we live after those? In that video I mentioned, the former social justice warrior said that when she was in the SJW movement, there was no space for happiness, for contentment, for gratitude, because you had to be continually agitated about the injustice in this world. And so now, having found the true story of Jesus, she can look back on and see how that left a gap in her life. I'm going to give just one example. It's very risky to give examples that are too current, lest those examples become the issue. But an example would be Marxism, right? And very simply put, it's about class battles. And the misery, according to Marxism, is that some people are too rich. Some people have too much power. And too many people are too poor. That's how they summarize the problem in this world, simplified. And so their solution, their deliverance is, we need to take power from the powerful. We need to take money from the rich and give it to the poor. That's not a complete ideology in the Christian Uber narrative. It has elements of Christianity, but it's not complete. It's not accurate. And so all these kind of ideas become isms. And racism is one of them. The belief that a particular race or culture is superior to any other or people of another color. And then people start acting out of that without even thinking about it. And problems arise because it's an incomplete ideology. It's mistaken. It's wrong. And our story, the story of Christianity, the Bible story, in response to those isms, is a very radical one that even this author that I just mentioned, Tom Holland, seems to be grappling with. It's so different from anything else. It says the misery, the problem with this world, is really me. And you'll notice that most ideologies do not spend a lot of time reflecting on my contribution to the problem in this world. That's where Christianity is different. What's the problem with this world? I'm the problem with this world. No one lives fully as God has made them to live. No one. No matter what gender, no matter what race, no matter what culture, no matter poor or rich, no one lives as God intended them to. Like Adam and Eve, all of us displace God with our own willfulness. Again, said very simply. And then when that happens, a lot of good things in life, things that are neutral on their own, I'll just use alcohol as an example, become icks. Or buying things becomes an ick. And so alcohol, when we indulge in that too much, we become alcohol ick. Or we become shopahol ick, right? So good things create icks in us when we've lost touch with the source of our true misery. Misery? What's the problem with the world? I'm the problem. I'm just like Adam and Eve. And I fail to live up to what God had hoped for from me. And then, of course, a layer on the problem is that we can't fix that ourselves. Not by all the good living, not by giving all of our possessions away. We can't fix that ourselves. And so the Bible tells many stories of that being tried and that being failed. So then, that's pretty miserable. And I remember as a kid, that's all I was left with out of most of the sermons that I heard, and I was left squirming, feeling like a worm. I call that worm theology, because I didn't catch the deliverance until I was somewhere around 30. How does that problem in me get corrected? See? Ideologies want to say, well, if the rich just smartened up, or if the white people just smartened up, or if the whoever just smartened up, then the world would be a better place. It's incomplete. There's truth to it, but it's incomplete. How does that problem get corrected? Well, it got corrected by a Jewish man who came into this world, God personified, truly innocent, who taught what God really wanted out of everyone, who was extremely threatening to the religious systems of his day, which is very important to notice, and the political systems of his day, and who has the end result, after 3 years of proclaiming and demonstrating this new way of being in the world, ended up tortured and on a cross and dead, innocently dead, tortured like a common criminal, and then came back. And then was raised because of his innocence. And once he was raised, he said to us, now the way is open for you to reconnect with God. Now the way is open for you to reconnect with God. That's different. That the hero dies and rises again and says, now you can live differently. So that's how we say in our Uber narrative, the problem in me gets corrected. Because once I know that, and once I own that death and resurrection as part of my story, then I can give up on legalism, right? And I can give up on all these other things, and I can live in answer to the third question, in gratitude. But there's a whole bunch of other words there that fit, in submission to God. I can rededicate my life every moment of every day to whatever God needs from me in it. And that's what Romans 12, verse 1 is about. And I'll finish with that verse, reading it again and just explaining it a little bit. Therefore, Paul has just in Romans explained the whole gospel story. He's in chapter 12 now. And so he says, in light of what I've all just laid out in the previous part of this letter, in view of God's mercy to us expressed in Jesus Christ, in view of God resolving our misery problem and delivering us from it, what you do now is you offer your entire life as a living sacrifice. You let go of the steering wheel to some degree, and you say, Lord, take the wheel. Or you let go of the reins if you're into the cowboy story, right? And you say, Lord, take over. Offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, your whole life, holy and pleasing to God. It becomes that as you offer it. And that is your true and proper worship. Beyond answering the first two questions of what's our misery, what's our deliverance, we live in gratitude and submission to God, asking Him to use us for all these good causes. Rectifying injustice, leveling the playing field, and all those good causes, but only rooted in what Christ has done. And God's people said, Amen. I'm going to offer a quick prayer. I know it's not on the plan here. And then after the prayer, we'll move to a song of response. So we'll stay meditative in that. Lord God, a lot of stories, a lot of ideas, a lot of patterns want to take over our lives and our living. And we followed some of them. We've become part of them, sometimes in ways that we haven't recognized. So help us to wake up to that, starting today. And help us also to refresh our waking up to the story of Jesus, who died on a cross, to rectify things, to make them right again. A tremendous injustice that was done to him in order to right the injustice that we commit by not living as you intended us to. We look forward to a day when all of that will be changed and all living things will be living as you intended them to. Until then, keep us strong in you and in your Uber story. For Jesus' glory, Amen.